The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for January 21st, 2017. I'd like to first offer a big congratulations to our new national cyclocross champion, Stephen Hyde. His quick thinking took him across the line after a flat tire, a broken rear derailleur hanger, and a fall. He had enough of a gap on second place Jamie Driscoll to run across the finish line, dragging his bike, and he took his place at the top of the podium. So congratulations to Stephen. Also, as of January 18th, Aussie Richie Porte leads the race down under, giving all his fellow country folk something to cheer about. And he not only has the leader's jersey, but he also has the King of the Mountain jersey and the sprint jersey. So what this portends for spring classics and European events is still yet to be seen. We'll keep an eye on Richie as the season progresses. Let's get on with this week's show. My first guest is Damon Reinhard. He is a speed freak. Now, I don't mean that in the druggy sense. I mean he loves things that go fast. His engineering background includes work in the aerospace field, and of course, he has a long history in the bicycle world. He is currently the lead engineer for the Cannondale division of Dorel's Cycling Sports Group and has some very interesting things to say about the equipment we see on the road today. Plus a lot more. Damon will be with me shortly. And then we'll be right back to speak with British cycling author Tim Moore. He's done some wild and wacky rides, and not only has lived to tell about them, he's written some great books about them, too. His book, Geronimo, detailed his crazy recreation of the 1914 Giro d'Italia on a 1914 wooden bike. And his new book, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, tells his story of riding the Iron Curtain Trail from north to south on a German MIFA 900 series bike. And, well, I'll let him tell you more about it. Eliciting both out loud laughter and some sobering insights into the post-Cold World War, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold might just be your next best bicycle read. So let me first introduce you to a most interesting and articulate guy, Damon Reinhard. Damon, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
It's my pleasure, Diane.
You have a long and interesting career in the bike business. Why don't you tell us a bit about your background and where you grew up, when you became interested in bicycles, and where you now reside?
Sure. I was born in Ithaca, New York. Lived there for just 2 years before following my family to Ohio. I grew up actually in Georgia, grade school and part of high school there. Went to high school in Pennsylvania. College in San Diego, worked at Kestrel in Northern California, and then moved to Wisconsin to work at Trek. I was there for about 7 or 8 years, and then Cervelo tempted me to Toronto, and Jane and I were there for about 7-ish years, and finally am now working at Cycling Sports Group here in Wilton, Connecticut.
Wow. So to say you've moved around a little bit is an understatement. So where were you in Ohio? That's where I am, and that's where the show is, emanates.
I was age 2, 3, and maybe a little bit of 4. We were in my house. That's where we were in Ohio.
Smart ass. Okay. I love it. So typical of a bike guy, right? Exactly.
Yeah. I gave you a precise answer.
Of course, because I are an engineer, right?
Exactly.
And I live with one. I know just how that is. All right. We won't worry about that.
My condolences.
You know, I've heard that before. Your professional life, while you did work in a bike shop when you were younger, your professional life didn't actually start out in the bicycle business. So before Kestrel, what were you doing?
I was working in San Diego, El Cajon, San Diego, at GKN Aerospace, Chemtronics. And it was a great experience for me to work there, mostly part-time, a little bit more than part-time, while I was studying also a little bit more than part-time to get my engineering degree at San Diego State University. And Chemtronics was just a beautiful place for an engineering student to witness all kinds of heavy and light and rough and precise manufacturing. They repaired jet engine fan blades. They manufactured titanium engine rings for the Joint Strike Fighter. They manufactured the nozzles, the exhaust nozzles on the space shuttle. It was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. You know, I'm reading Elon Musk's book right now, and there's a lot of aerospace stuff in that and stuff I never really thought about. I mean, I guess you just don't think about it. And then the new movie that's out, Hidden Figures, with all the space stuff. Yeah, it was excellent. Saw that last week.
That's good to have your recommendation. I'd love to see that movie. What's interesting about aerospace to me is that it's not really a commercial product. I mean, the people buying it are the airplane guys, so you don't have necessarily a big marketing spin. You don't have colors and graphics. And as a result, there are stories in aerospace, like there was a piece that fit in one of the airframes. We didn't work on it, but it was flat on the bottom, kind of a plate, rectangular shape. It was rounded over the top. It kind of looked like a tombstone. And it gained the nickname in the factory of the tombstone. And wouldn't you know it, there was a plane crash and they found the tombstone. When that made the news, then we had to stop calling it the tombstone.
It was a little tacky at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got it. So you moved on to carbon fiber, working with Kestrel. You actually have an interesting story about making a carbon fiber frame. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I learned so much working at Kestrel. At that time, carbon fiber for most bike guys was kind of a mystery, and for me too, when I started working there. And I was working there about 3.5, 4 years and learned so much that when I left Kestrel, I felt like I knew enough to make a one-off carbon fiber bike in my garage. And so I used a lot of the techniques that I witnessed and practiced at Kestrel. They had a repair shop there that was pretty active. And I just carved a foam core to shape my design and started laying up carbon fiber over it. And with hindsight, it seems now that every kid in Southern California used the same technique to make a couple surfboards every summer. So it wasn't that high tech.
Well, but, you know, a surfboard's in the water. A bicycle frame is on two wheels on land. I think it's a little different. Did you actually ride that bike?
Yeah, I was scared of it at first, and so I made a test fixture. And I measured the G-forces on the biggest bump that was close to my house. There was a drainage ditch right across the road, a little bit of a steep, sharp angle there. And I actually bought a G-force meter, refurbished G-force meter from an airplane, and put it on the dash of my car and drove as fast as I dared over that ditch. I got 3 Gs, and so I made a tattletale on my bike. The top tube flexes. It's a beam bike. And I rode around a couple of rides with a pencil on a stick sticking out of the seat post, writing on a piece of cardboard there that would record, like a Geiger counter, the movement of the beam. And so then I put that into a wooden test fixture I made. I bought a hydraulic ram with a gauge, and I calculated the force displacement, and I got that thing up to just what I'd measured. And I wanted to go 50% more as a factor of ignorance. Engineers are known to talk about a factor of safety. Well, I didn't know enough, so I just called it a factor of ignorance. I don't know. Maybe I need 50% more. And it broke.
It did.
Yeah, it broke, so I had to remake the top half of the frame. After that, I did ride around a lot.
We rode a carbon beam bike. We rode a Commotion that had the soft ride carbon beam for a while, and I liked that bike.
That was a soft one, yeah.
Yeah, and then we rode a Calfee carbon tandem for a while, and I like that bike a lot.
Yep.
I do like carbon fiber, although I have to admit, I'm very partial to steel also.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I want to talk about going fast, because you like things that go fast, evidently. You were a race engineer at Garmin Cervelo. Tell me first what a race engineer does, and then, excluding the talent of the rider, what makes a bicycle fast?
Those are good questions. A race engineer, as far as we knew at the time in 2009 and 2010, was a newly created title. And surely somebody must have been doing the task that I was doing beforehand, but maybe without the title, or maybe we're just mistaken. But a race engineer in our case was me. I was the role was created on January in 2009 when the team manager called up Cervelo and said, hey, 40 bicycles don't work. And we had just shipped them their first shipment of bikes for 2009. And leading up to that, beforehand, we had started shipping this new model, so it was newly on the market. And customer service at Cervelo had gotten, you know, one or two calls from one or two dealers. It went to one or two different customer service people. And when we finally got the call from the team manager, it was the same issue, and it was obvious that we had to deal with it. And without the test team, we would have waited probably months before even realizing that it was a big problem. The bikes didn't shift well. If it were a structural story, I wouldn't be telling it.
Well, we could blame it on whoever the component manufacturer is, right?
Well, that's the thing. The bike is one of the components in the shifting system. The levers and the cables, where they go into the frame, the cable follows the path the frame designer has designed into the frame. And we had given just a little bit too much friction in that path. It saved 4 watts. And so it was tempting to keep that design, and so we re-engineered the internal routing to reduce the friction, and it worked.
I was always curious about internally routed cabling because of how you had to thread it through the frame. And sometimes you were lucky and sometimes you weren't. In the early days. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Damon Renard. He now works up in Wilton, Connecticut and it's not just Cannondale, it's a group of cycling sports group. What's connected besides Cannondale up there, just as an aside here?
Sure. CSG, Cycling Sports Group, is Dorel Industries Group with cycles. There's also Pacific Cycle in Madison, Wisconsin. And between the two of us, we handle a bunch of brands. The bike brands that are handled here in Wilton are Cannondale and GT. And as the engineering manager for road bikes, the only GT models that I handle are the road GTs, like the GT Grade, for example. And then most people are probably familiar with a lot of Cannondale different road bikes.
Oh, yeah. Cad this, Cad that. Yep. Oh, I can remember. Yep. I was a Cannondale dealer back in the day. Let's talk about some of the improvements you've seen since the days at Kestrel moving forward, not just in carbon fiber, because obviously there has been a lot of development with laying up carbon and some of that, but just the bicycle itself in modern times. What do you think have been some of the biggest improvements that have worked in your favor as an engineer in cycling?
Some of the biggest improvements have been widespread, and to me the biggest improvements at bikes is at the mid to lower price points. I bought my first 10-speed in the 1970s during the bike boom, and for what we paid then for bikes, you can now buy a bike that's so much better. Braking is better, shifting is better, the weight is lighter, the bikes are actually stronger. You might remember seeing all those bikes riding around with bent forks and buckled top and down tubes, and people just kept riding them mostly.
Yeah, that's because they ran into things.
Exactly. Well, they still ran into things, but with stronger frames and stronger test standards, bikes don't bend and break that much like they used to bend a lot. The bikes are better fitting. They're more ergonomic. I mean, brake lever hoods are much nicer to put your hands on these days. Saddles are better. Those mid-price bikes are just fantastic.
Do you think that there is, and I've asked other people this, recently Richard Swin says you get a lot of bang for your buck with a bicycle today, but do you think there is some sort of a barrier for getting more people into cycling at that lower end, at mid-price? I don't know what mid-price means. I guess I don't know enough about what's out there right now, and I should.
For me, mid-price is like a CAD 12, a Cannondale CAD 12, say Ultegra components, aluminum frame, a nice carbon fork. Or even a CAD 8, just a step down in the frame, and you can still buy it with 105 parts and stuff.
Oh, nice.
And to me, that's as the engineering manager of road bikes, I can't just always only ride the Cannondale Black Ink Evo full carbon high mod stuff. Most people who buy bikes aren't buying the high-end bikes, and they have to be good, so people buy the high-end bikes, but most people, their only experience of Cannondale is a CAD 8 or a CAD 12. And so those bikes have to work well, too. And that's kind of where my heart is. I say I have an Ultegra heart.
You know what? We have an Ultegra heart, too. What do you think of all the new DI stuff, all the and EPS stuff, the electronic stuff?
I think it's good. It doesn't make you faster, but it is nice. And it eliminates the problem that we had with Cervella Test Team with the mechanical shift cables adding friction through the curves inside the frame. We actually made a lab test to measure the friction in the frame where the cables pass through. And you can easily double or triple the friction there by making too many curves. So that's really nice to be able to put numbers on that. It's one of the things I like about an engineer. Being an engineer, you can measure and quantify and then redesign and improve performance and be sure of it.
Do you see anything in the future? I mean, we've gone from 5-speed to 6-speed to 7-speed to 8-speed, 9-speed, 10-speed, 11-speed. We're going from triples to compacts. We're doing disc brakes and all of that. Do you see anything that is radically different coming up or down the pike?
As the engineering manager, I've got engineers who are supposed to think of those things, and we have a research group here, which is checking out new materials, new manufacturing techniques. The goals are always about the same, to make the bikes faster and lighter. In general, I think we have enough gears. I'm afraid for the tandem market, it looks like triples are going away, and I think tandems need triples. The main things that excite me about the future are that faster bikes are coming. And I know that you mentioned not everyone wants to go faster. Faster isn't the thing for everyone. But even if you don't want to go faster, if you buy a bike that is designed to be faster, you don't have to go faster. You can go the same speed, just, you know, easier.
Well, that's true. What about e-bikes? Do you see a future for e-bikes for a specific portion of the population? I don't think Cannondale's going that direction, or is it?
We have a big e-bike market in Europe, and so we have a design office in Europe, an engineering office there, and they're working on e-bikes, have e-bikes in the market already in Europe. And the laws are, I'm not that up to speed with the laws in America versus Europe. I think there are two classes in Europe and one in America. But yeah, we are making e-bikes, and we see a big future in e-bikes.
That's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, let's hope infrastructure starts to actually move in the right direction here, too.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Sheldon Brown, Mr. Insane Sheldon Brown. Unfortunately, he is no longer with us, but certainly a lot of what he did and who he was is still around. Tell us a Sheldon Brown story.
When the internet was about that big, I looked all over and I found all the bike sites there were. I'm sure bike geeks in those days all did the same thing, and we knew Sheldon Brown's site. And there was also Rec Bicycles Tech, the news group. And I became known in Rec Bicycles Tech for answering questions. I'd worked in bike shops and had some experience. And in 1994-ish, I had already left Kestrel. And so I had worked at one of the most highly regarded brands in North America. So people, I think, respected my comments on, in part because of that as well. So when I finally accepted my job offer at Trek, I showed up, and one of the second or third meetings I had was with the Trek's in-house legal counsel, Bob Burns, one of the funniest lawyers I've ever met.
Oh, that's sort of like an oxymoron, but okay, we'll go with it.
It is an oxymoron. He addressed the engineers and said, your job, number one job, is to make bikes that don't kill people, or worse, injure them. And like, what? How is injury worse than death? And he laughed and said, well, if somebody dies, you pay the estate and you're done. If they're injured, you keep on paying them all lifelong.
Interesting.
Yeah, so he sat me down and said, welcome to Trek. Damon, you're going to have to stop that website. I had a DamonReiner.com bicycle tech website. And to be honest, I was a little bit relieved. The website had all the stuff on it that I was interested in, and people would email me with homework assignments. Can you calculate the statistical likelihood of punctures on these tires? And I don't want to keep a database like that. I just wanted to go fast. So I ended the website. And he gave me a month, and I posted on the homepage of the website, DamonReiner.com, we'll be closing. And within a few weeks, the word spread on Rec Bikes Tech, and Sheldon Brown emailed me and said, this is a useful website. I'd like to archive it on SheldonBrown.com. And I hadn't spoken with him much or emailed with him much, but we knew of each other. And I agreed. I said, that's great. Just archive it as it is. He said, okay, I'll do that. But I'm not going to post all those pictures. He said, I had a collection of awkward, weird, cool, futuristic frame designs right before the UCI canned all that. And I guess he wasn't interested in hosting the space there. But he took all the rest of the stuff, and it's still there to this day, a snapshot of DamonMiner.com from about 2001 or so.
Wow. Well, I know John Allen works on the site now and kind of keeps it up to date as best he can. I mean, there was only one Sheldon Brown, frankly.
There was. John has big shoes to fill. He's doing a good job.
Right. So if you're in the high-end, go-fast department, and that's what interests you, the racing end of the market tests sort of your product, wittingly or unwittingly. You guys sponsor a team, don't you?
Yeah, we have Cannondale Trepec Pro Cycling Team.
And how are they doing?
They're great. I know the head mechanic, Jeff Brown. He's a Canadian guy, and I met him first when I worked at Trek. I think Lance had won, I don't know which tour it was, and they came to visit us. And at the time, I was in Trek's Advanced Concept Group. We had a special exclusive room where I think it was about seven of us worked on Advanced Concept stuff. And it had two doors, so you could close the doors. And that was a meeting place for Lance. So he came in, greeted all of us, and he doesn't know anything about bikes, by the way.
And I am not surprised by that comment, by the way.
Right, yeah. I'd never met him before, and I was a little disappointed in my then hero. But anyway, the mechanics also came. So Lance was dismissed, and we sat down with the mechanics to do some real engineering work. And that's when I met Jeff Brown. He was the junior mechanic then, reporting to the Discovery Pro Cycling Team head mechanic, Julian DeVries. And I'm sorry, I probably said his Belgian name wrong. But Julian was an older mechanic who had been the head mechanic for Le Monde before Armstrong. And before that, I want to say Eddie Merckx, maybe. Quite a guy. And Jeff Brown reported to Julian DeVries. In fact, Julian was on Greg LeMond's team when they were riding Bottecchia, and they got the first aero bars permitted in the Tour de France. It might have been 1989 or so, and later on Scott made the Scott drop-in handlebar. That's the drop bar
right
on a road bike that curls around to the drops and keeps on curling towards the middle to make kind of an aero grip just below the tops of the handlebars. And LeMond named that bar the Julien bar, and that was about 1989. At that time I was working at Kestrel, and we saw pictures of the version that had struts from the aero grip on the bar down to the middle of the fork blade. And at that time, Greg's team was riding on Kestrel forks. And when we saw those pictures, we could imagine the stress on the carbon fiber fork blade from that clamp on the strut. So we called up Bob LeMond and said, hey, send us some of those clamps. We want to make sure you're not weakening the fork. And so I was the only guy in Watsonville who had a pair of Julien Scott drop-in bars with the struts. Turns out it was fine. It was really an interesting way that Boone Lennon had made that strut. It was just a brake cable pulled through a hole in the handlebar, and he wrapped it around the bolt that had a radiator hose clamp, and he tightened the clamp around the fork. And all of this was hidden. The clamp had a heat-shrink plastic cover, and the strut, the cable strut, was just made an airfoil out of some of those plastic report binders, you know, the spine on the clear plastic covers.
Yeah.
And he put Scott stickers on it. It was all good. So we approved it, and there it goes. We were off with that. But that's Julian.
UCI probably would have thrown it out, right?
You know, they let it in.
Oh, did they? Really?
Yeah. Julian told the story about how they got the aero bars in. Was it aero bars? Yeah, I think so. They went to the Tour de France organizers, the commissars there, and they said, you know, we want to use these special aero bars on the time trial. You know, Greg is getting old. He's lost the last tour, and he's kind of an old man. His back hurts. He just wants to rest and be relaxed and more comfortable there. And they told him that was the purpose, and then he won the race.
That's great. What a great story. Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Damon. I evidently pronounced it incorrectly. It's Reynard.
My grandmother, says Reynard, and my brothers and I agreed that this is the generation we're going to answer also to Reynard. Either is fine.
Okay. Well, that's good. I don't feel terrible then. I ask everybody this question, but now I have one of those like classic engineers in my grips. What do you think about road discs?
I'm agnostic and I'm pragmatic.
Okay.
I'm agnostic because when someone asks if something's good, I usually ask, good for what?
That sounds like an engineer.
Yeah, what's the parameters we're aiming for here? And then you can see and compare whether it performs within the parameters. My experience with discs and rim brakes on road bikes shows me there's a place for both in the market, I think. Disc brakes have a lot of advantages, and for me, modulation is the main one. Also, they work well when they're wet, and that's important for riders in a lot of places in the world, like the UK and New Zealand. Now, they also have their disadvantages, which plenty of folks are happy to point out. It's good the bike industry offers riders the choice, and most of our high-end road bikes here at Cannondale are available in both rim and disc versions. The trend is towards discs, so if you don't like discs, hang on to your old bike or just get used to it. Wait a year or two if you're not an early adopter, and road bikes are going towards disc brakes.
What about the stresses on the forks? I look at carbon fiber forks and a caliper brake, and I look at disc brakes. I mean, I'm not an engineer, but I'm wondering if there are issues or if there have been issues and what's been done to change forks.
You're exactly right. The disc brake caliper just bounces on one leg, and it has higher forces into the leg at that point. And the safety is that we've got test standards that take that into account, and we test the forks with a simulated wheel with a radius that effectively simulates the road contact point. And there's a force applied there which would tip you over the handlebars if you were riding a bike and put on the brakes with that force. And it's cycled in fatigue to test the ultimate strength and also fatigue on that. And so forks have been beefed up in response. Some steel forks will buckle if you just add on the disc brake mount tabs and grab a handful of brake in the right conditions. You can just buckle an unreinforced fork. Luckily, with carbon, it's easy to just add a few more layers. It does add a little weight. I think it's between like 100 grams and 120 grams or something like that over an equivalent rim brake fork. But the strength of the forks is not an issue.
Okay. Taking it from you, it sounds a little more reasonable to me. I don't know. You know, I'm one of these scared people. Just make it safe. I want it to be safe.
Yeah, you're probably in the middle of the bell curve. They taught in engineering, the customer base is made up of different types of consumers. And in the middle, there are people that are pretty pragmatic, pretty safety conscious, not too willing to take a risk. And at the early tail end, there's the people that stand in line overnight around the block to buy the first iPhone.
True. That is so true.
So maybe that's not where you are, but some people are there.
Yeah, I do know that some people are there. They always want the newest, the best, and the fastest. So I'm going to wrap it up with my usual weirdo questions. What's your favorite food?
I am a vegetarian.
Okay, I do not hold that against you.
I'm actually not. This is a joke, but I do like these candies that have vegetable names like jelly beans, candy corn, candy fruit slices, circus peanuts. That's my favorite food.
You're the first person to ever not answer the question with like pizza, burgers, or like Taylor Finney said, I like a good sandwich. He was hilarious.
Like a sandwich is a particular kind of sandwich.
Just a good sandwich. What music do you listen to?
My brother, Clark, my younger brother, is an improvisational jazz pianist.
Ooh.
And he made a solo CD, and I have a copy of it somewhere. I'd like to listen to those. When he and my other brother were starving students, they worked as bike couriers in Portland, Oregon. And they'd set off in the morning on their bikes, and Nick would get his walkie-talkie radio and scramble to deliver packages. But Clark parked his bike at a piano bar and collected tips in his helmet by playing the piano all day.
That's awesome. What a great story. So you have two brothers, obviously.
Three, actually. There's an older one as well.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
One sister.
Wow. Big family.
Yeah.
And how about pets? I mean, I'm all into pets.
Yeah. We have one gray cat. Her name is Shadow because of her color. And it's interesting. She has her own Facebook page, Shadow Reinhardt. Yeah. And when Facebook did the purging of all the non-real names, Shadow apparently flipped their flag and they emailed Shadow and said, you can't have this name. And so my wife, Jane, is just brilliant. She gave Shadow a middle initial O and just changed her first name to Shad. So that's Shad O, Reinhardt. She actually has tons of friends, Facebook friends. A lot of them are other animals who have their own Facebook pages. And Shadow has talked some animals' parents into letting their own animals create their own Facebook pages to become her friend. And Shadow's got a lot of pro cyclists as friends, and she comments on the pros as they report their training and racing adventures. Shadow's much funnier than I am. She's almost 16 years old, and she has a junior membership to the American Automobile Association, the AAA.
That's awesome. Yesterday, I teach yoga, and I taught Cats on Mats. I teach it once a month. And they told me we were going to have a big surprise. The big surprise was a 27-pound orange tabby, who, by the way, has lost 5 pounds since he's been at the shelter, named Colby. He is the biggest thing I have seen in a long time. So I understand about older cats. His owner unfortunately passed away and they surrendered the cat. So hopefully somebody adopted him yesterday after our class. Anyway, this has just been a delightful conversation. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope we get to meet up. Do you ever go out to the North American Handmade Show?
I never have made it. I've often wanted to go, and I haven't made it there. I do have friends and relatives in Ohio, so there's possibilities there.
Well, I'm up in the northeast corner, better known as Cleveland, home of the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Cleveland Indians, and we won't talk about that other team. That ruined its own failing record by winning a game, for heaven's sakes.
Oh, wow.
Well, thanks so much, Heyman. Have a really wonderful day, and thanks for talking with me.
Diane, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Damon Reinhardt spoke with me from the offices of Cannondale, where he is the lead engineer there. What an interesting conversation. What a great guy. We need to take a break. We will be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back, and we are heading over to England to speak with author Tim Moore about his new book, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold. Hello, Tim Moore. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me. As a writer of cycling stories, I want to know about you and your background, where you grew up, how you got into cycling, and how cycling became your writing topic.
Well, London, to be honest, is not really a terribly nice place to cycle around. So having learned to ride a bike, I didn't really do very much of it as I was growing up. But one thing that did happen, when I was a student, they started showing highlights from the Tour de France. Just at a time, there was some sort of terrible afternoon quiz show that was on. And being a student, that was basically my job, was to watch afternoon TV. And then afterwards, on the same channel, because I was a student, again, I was too lazy to get up and switch over, the Tour de France came on. I think that was 1987. So I'm afraid we are talking quite a long time ago now. But I got really, really into it. And developed a sort of fascination with the Tour, and I just loved the whole, you know, the glamour of it and the terrible suffering that you saw taking place, and the way that it just took over this entire country, and it all kind of began from there. And then I got into cycling in a slightly more serious way. I ended up riding across my first travel book. I was following in the footsteps of this eccentric Victorian guy, and he went across Iceland on a horse. So I thought, I will go across Iceland on a bicycle. And that was the first serious bit of cycling I'd done. And even though it was pretty tough, I have to say, but I was sustained by using this sort of inner monologue of all these, like, you know, kind of commentator catchphrases I'd heard by. So it was like, and here is Moore on his 2,000-kilometer lone breakaway across the interior of this punishing island and all that kind of stuff. So that was really how it began. And then I did a book about the Tour de France and kicked on from there.
So let's talk a little bit about your book. You take a topic. For example, this time you rode the length of the old Iron Curtain. You added a very strange and quirky bike and then related the story. So the new book, which is The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, let's begin with the reason you decided this trip was a good idea. What was that reason again?
Well, the trip was never really a good idea, to be honest, but it was it occurred to me. I was actually in Italy on a very, very hot, sunny day, and a journalist phoned me up and said, I just wonder what you think about this new Iron Curtain Trail bike route. And I didn't think much because I'd never heard of it until he told me. But so that was a short conversation, but it kind of got me thinking, and it was a very, very hot really, really hot summer, and I suddenly thought, wouldn't that be nice? Because I've done a lot of cycling, and I've done a lot of cycling generally, and really the Icelandic one that I mentioned earlier, it's generally very, very hot. It would be nice to be a nice, cool flat road in Finland at some point. And then I guess also the other thing it was that I'm a child of the Cold War, you know, so the first half of my adult life really was spent with the shadow of imminent nuclear apocalypse hanging over it, which is obviously a bit of a formative experience. And it was interesting because obviously when you're growing up in the sort of 60s, 70s, early 80s, you realize that you are being sort of indoctrinated by your own propaganda from your own side, that these people over the other side of the Iron Curtain are the baddies, and they're the sort of the creepy, you know, spies and all the James Bond films and that sort of thing. But of course, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, well, I'm sure they're just people at the end of the day. And so I was interested to kind of, I went over there in 1990 until just after the Berlin Wall came down into a lot of these countries, and it was fascinating. And 26 years has gone by, and I guess it still seems to me a novelty somehow that I'm allowed to go into places like, you know, Russia and the Baltic states and so on. It seems like it still seems to be kind of behind the enemy lines, as it were. So that's still a novelty. And I guess you always need to up the ante. So I've done a few fairly difficult things on bicycles. You can't really kind of go back down. You can't sort of do something that's a bit less challenging and easier. So having done the last book I did was the 1914 Giro d'Italia on a 1914 bicycle. So yeah, I kind of thought I should do this Iron Curtain Trail, which is a really, really long way. It's basically the entire length of continental Europe, from right at the very top of Norway, the entire length of Finland, through Russia, the Baltic states, and then, you know, Poland, you know, what would have been East-West Germany, you know, Czech Republic, all the way down to the Black Sea, the Bulgarian coast there. And that's about, I mean, it's sort of 5,000-6,000 miles, really. Probably 8,558 kilometres if somebody wants to do the exact translation there. But it was an awfully long way. And I thought, well, I should do it on an appropriate bicycle. And then I found out about this. In a way, the bike almost came first, because I just, by coincidence, really, I just happened to find out. I spent a lot of time looking at rubbish on the internet, and I always like to look at other countries' eBay sites. And I was looking at German eBay, and I found there's quite a lot of these old East German, you know, communist era shopping bicycles. So they're bikes with very small 20-inch wheels. Most of them fold in half. Actually, they're fold-in bikes. And there were quite a lot of these things. They're called the MIFA 900 series. And I did a bit of research, and I found out that they actually produced 3 million of these things from the 60s to the late 80s. 1990, actually, they stopped making them. And, you know, I did a bit of more research and found out if you take China out of the equation, that is basically the most widely produced bicycle in history. So I thought, well, I've just got to do it on one of these things.
Yeah, that was really brilliant, at least in theory. I want to ask you one question before we get on with the bike, because just the description of how you chose this bike and what you had to do with it, and then the commentary you got after you chose the bike was hilarious. But when you made this choice to do this journey, did you approach your editor, or how did you go about getting the trip together so that you could write this book?
Well, I had to sell the idea of doing it to my editor. So I said that I've had this idea, and generally speaking, I've done a number of travel books, but they're always slightly more kindly disposed to cycling based travel books, purely because in commercial terms, they're the ones I've written that have sold the most copies. So it was,
makes sense.
I didn't need to persuade them too much. I probably should have just, I was so pleased when they said yes. I didn't really sort of sit down and think, actually, is this, as you said earlier, is this really a good idea? So I just kind of, and then I always get really excited about the equipment on these things. It's much more interesting to, as any cyclist knows, really, to like fiddle about with like, you know, getting kit and sort of supplies and stuff than it is to do really boring things like, getting into correct physical shape. Because I don't really, as I said, I live in London. It's not really a great place for cycling, and I tend to not really do any cycling at all for about 2 years, and then go off and do way too much of it on inappropriate machinery. So And I made that mistake in spades this time.
Yes, you did. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tim Moore. His new book is The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold. He traveled the entire length of the Iron Curtain Trail, all the way from north to south, which is another question. You decided to start north in the winter. And the first few days, you're lucky you survived that.
Yeah, I should have. Everyone said, well, why don't you start at the other end? Start at the other end in Bulgaria, then you end up in the, then way north of the Arctic Circle when it's sort of summertime and not covered in snow and so on, which I agree is definitely a more sensible proposition. But there are two things. One is that, and this is a bit embarrassing, it's just the kind of idiot's gravity of the map, because it's, if you start in the north and go down, it's downhill, isn't it? It's like, so I'm afraid that was a factor. And still, I'm sitting here and I've got a massive map of Europe on the wall of my little office here, and I'm looking at it. But the other factor was I had actually been to Finland a couple of times over the years, and no disrespect to Finland, well, maybe a little bit of disrespect, it's not actually terribly interesting as a nation. So it's gigantic. So I thought, do I want the glorious narrative arc of my tale to end on 1,000 miles of no people and just loads of really flat landscape covered in pine trees and the odd lake? That's a challenge. That's a challenge to make that interesting. So I thought I'll make Finland interesting by doing it first in the middle of winter. And it certainly was interesting.
Yes, it certainly was. Given your description of it, it was a little beyond interesting. It was like brutal.
Yeah, it was. It was. I thought I'd been a bit sensible. I thought I'd kind of done a lot of research about the historical weather patterns in that part of Lapland up there in the north of Finland. And it seemed to me that by the middle of March was when I set off. It was, generally speaking, winter was pretty much over. And we're talking, this is 2015 that I went off. So, and sure enough, by the start of March 2015, I was looking at a little webcam outside Kirkenes, which is the town where I was starting off, right on the very top of Norway, just on top of Finland up there. And it showed this sort of this mini roundabout outside the police station. And it was covered in snow when I first started looking at it. And then it slowly, this patch of snow retreated, and then about 3 days before I'm leaving, there's no snow. Fantastic. And then looked at it the next morning, so 2 days before I'm leaving, and it's a complete whiteout blizzard. And winter returned with a most awful vengeance. And my flight out there was diverted because the plane couldn't land because of the snow. And I just started. I think I was just in shock, to be honest. The whole thing was so ludicrous. It was this howling blizzard. It was freezing cold. I wore an awful lot of clothing, but the outer layer, which is kind of like, you know, snow jacket anorak thing, I thought, what the hell's going on? I went up the first out of this town, this first really big hill, which is obviously a bit of a challenge on a shopping bike, which I should point out only has two gears. I sweated a lot because I wasn't in great shape, and the sweat sort of went out to the outer layer and just froze solid. So the whole of this anorak was just, it was frozen to a kind of exoskeleton. I could have actually taken it off and stood it up in the snow beside me. And I think the only thing that really, it was just because I was just in disbelief. That's probably what kept me going for the first few weeks. Just, it seems so bad, really. So out of what I'd imagined, and so scary. I just kind of blanked out what I was, and just focused on just like the next 5 minutes. I'm just like, oh well, I'll just carry on without thinking of the big picture. I took a great big laminated A4 bit of paper with the map of the entire route, and I thought it'll be a fun evening activity. I'll just get my little marker pen out and color in my progress. And I couldn't, after about 3 weeks, I think I'd managed to colour in about a little fingernail length on this huge line all the way through Europe. So I just couldn't bear to look at it. I didn't look at it for about another month, actually. It was just too disheartening.
How long did it take to do the whole thing?
It took me 3 months in the end. I mean, three months to the day. And the only way to do it, because obviously on a shopping bike, you don't go very fast, really. I mean, the one thing which probably saved me was that it's the first half of the route. So the first 2,000 or 3,000 miles really is almost completely flat. There are no real hills along the Baltic coast. So by the time there were hills and then actually gigantic mountains, I was just by default in incredibly good shape because I'd just done so. It's like sort of sitting on an exercise bike for 2 months, the initial bit. So I was in very good shape. So when the mountains came along, I soared up them on this improbable machine with little wheels and no gears.
The bike itself, this little MIFA 900, you got a lot of flack about it from people. I don't know. You must have researched it on the internet. I think that's what I remember. And people were going, well, you're crazy. It only has two speeds. Or it only had one speed, but you happened to get one that had two speeds, something like that. So did this bike actually hold up for 8,000 kilometers, 9,000 kilometers?
Well, I've got to say, I mean, exactly. Everyone said to me, I found this forum with these old German guys who have a fondness for the old bicycles of their youth. These old East German guys, and they all said, oh yes, the MIFA 900. And then when I actually explained what I was going to do to it, they said, please don't do that. I mean, insofar as you can, in a reply on an internet forum, grab someone by the lapels and try and shake sense into them. They did that. They said, please avoid, it will become a horror show, and all that sort of thing. But I set off anyway, and yeah, so I did find, I've got to say, and I can't quite understand why these exist. I think the Schwalbe Tire Company manufacture nail-studded snow tires for 20-inch shopping bicycles. Why? Why would anyone in their right mind ever go out in the snow on a bike with tiny wheels? Anyway, it was very good for me because I was that idiot who was doing that stupid thing. So without them, I probably would never go out of Finland. So that was a handy discovery. But the bike itself, I mean, certain things did, because I did fiddle about with, as you said, I sort of found this West German bike of the similar 1960s vintage that had this two-speed automatic hub thing. So I put one of those on. I did other bits which I thought were making it a bit more durable. I changed the cranks, but of course, because I'm not massively competent, the things that did go wrong with the bike in the first few weeks were things that I had tried to do to improve it. So the cranks, I hadn't tightened them up enough, and one of them, you know, the sort of square hole in the middle of it got completely rounded off. And the nice Finnish farmers were very, very good. They were very, very resourceful. I think if you're not very resourceful in that part of Finland, you probably just die. So they were fantastic, and they came out with these huge tool sets and sort of banging the bike into shape and patched it together to go another 20, 30 miles to the next farm. In the end, I did manage to. My wife came out just near the end of Finland. I think she was worried I was going a bit mad, actually, because she was talking to me on the phone every night and slightly worried about the fact I was repeating myself every 5 minutes and bursting into tears and that sort of thing. So she came out. She brought out a replacement crank. And after that, to be honest, I mean, yeah, lots of things kind of, you know, lots of, they had a front and back light little luggage rack for putting your shopping when you went to the East German supermarket, which I put all my luggage on, you know, which is obviously, you know, I had a lot of stuff. So I had a lot, much more stuff than this poor bike was designed to equip with. So the luggage racks did, lots of bits fell off them and lots of the rivets broke on those. I suppose when you spend that amount of time with a bicycle, you don't really notice gradual declines in its condition. So it did hold together, I mean, you know, really astoundingly well. But when I listened to some of the, because I made lots of these voice recordings all the way through, that was how I did my, you know, I couldn't have time to stop and write things down. And basically when I'm in Finland, I'm wearing five pairs of mittens, so you're not really going to write anything. So I had to use my phone, I use voice recordings. And when I listened to the ones from near the end, when I'm getting to the finish line, in the background of my, you know, sort of great eulogy to myself of finishing this epic ride, I can hardly hear what I'm saying because the bike is making these terrible sort of unlubricated shrieks and rattles and everything. I mean, listening to it, you would be amazed that the bike making that noise should have managed to go as far as it did. But it did. That was actually one part of it, I suppose. I mean, also, yeah, I mean, it seemed appropriate because I'm a bit old and unfit for purpose. The bike was similarly unfit for purpose and a bit old. And I think that was always the idea that it was such a basic machine. It was, you know, the bicycle boiled down to its fundamental essence, just, you know, it only had one brake and things like that. So there's so few, but I thought, well, I wanted to, in a way, prove that the bike, even in its humblest incarnation, was a sort of machine you could get on and do even really quite ambitious things. It would take you anywhere. And it did. So hats off to the MIFA 900.
We will put it on a pedestal and give it a podium. We could give it like a jersey, right?
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, we should. I want to talk a little bit about the journey itself and some of the things that weren't so humorous. You talk about some sobering moments and thought-provoking scenes. Can you relay some of those feelings about the Cold War generation and what your sense of those who experienced the Iron Curtain and how they might have felt or feel now that they're kind of free, but somehow they're not?
Yeah, well, it was very interesting. And I mean, it was such a, you know, the Soviet Empire as it was such a huge and very disparate kind of empire. So lots of different sorts of people, lots of different cultures and attitudes. I suppose the most interesting part, in a way, is the Baltic states, which are the ones that are, you know, just below Russia on the sea there. There's three of them. They're all very small. But it's interesting there because even those have a very different take on it. So Estonia, which is the first one, and I was cycling through that, and it seemed, you know, very, very prosperous. And, you know, everyone was, you know, looking kind of, you know, healthy and wealthy and so on. And I thought, well, this is the happy ending here. They've come from the shadow of the Soviet Empire and made a very lovely future for themselves. And it's all, but then you cycle, you know, not very far really, and they're going into Latvia, and it's just like you're back in Russia in 1948 or something, and everything seems really dour and broken down, and people look a bit kind of bit desperate and a bit, you know, angry really. And lots of, I mean, in Russia, lots of just a lot of hostility. And I think it's just because, yeah, that for these people, their lives have just gone wrong, and things have, you know, then they probably do feel a fondness really for the old days, because at least then they probably felt people would tell me we had more respect in the old days. We were, you know, Russia, the Soviets, you know, we were a world power. You know, we were on the world stage. People took us seriously. And now, you know, and it's a very difficult situation, because also the Stalin put lots of, you know, the countries he thought might give him some trouble, like some of the Baltic states. He thought, well, the best way to address this, I'll put loads and loads of ethnic Russians in there, so that they will feel a sort of, you know, hardwired, you know, affinity to Mother Russia. And of course now some of these countries, I mean, I went through towns, and I, you know, the first town I went into in Estonia, I was so relieved to get out of Russia, because it was, the driving was terrible, everyone was, you know, drunk and a bit angry. It was really really not much fun. And I went into the first guest house in Estonia, and just, I said, I'm just so happy to be out of Russia. And the woman behind the desk said, oh well, I'm Russian. She said that actually we're all Russian, and 94% of this town is Russian, because that's the way it's gone. So I do, the Baltics in particular is going to be a bit of a mess, just because lots of people, they say, well, we don't like, I'm not saying, you know, we admire Putin, but nonetheless, you know, if Russia came and, you know, took back, you know, Latvia, where I live now, then I would feel more at home. So, you know, it's not as clear cut as people think. But in terms of the, yeah, I mean, you know, places like Poland and the Czech Republic, I mean, these places, I suppose the ones that really put up the most, and Hungary, the most resistance during the Soviet era, they haven't looked back really, and they're, you know, kind of doing very well for themselves. They feel you know, like kind of modern European nations largely. Germany is a different case, because that was obviously a nation that was actually split in two. And it was interesting just seeing that the different attitudes to people there. For instance, I could, even though obviously the border isn't there anymore, I could always tell when I was back in the old east, because obviously this path tries to hug the border as close as possible, so you're always crisscrossing. I mean, obviously in some ways it was, the houses look a bit tattier, and sometimes there were lots of cobbles and things, but also people were actually friendlier in the east, and they would wave at me in the way that they didn't in the west. And I think that's probably because still, certainly the older generation, they're still not quite used to the idea of, you know, strangers cycling through their little village, because maybe for 30, 40 years they were no strangers, they were no foreigners, and so it's a new face, and they would give you a cheery wave, so it's still a novelty for them. So it was a very interesting kind of voyage of discovery, really.
Wow, I would say so. Let me once again remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tim Moore about his new book, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, a journey from all the way north in Finland, all the way to the Baltic Sea, about 8,600 kilometers. Before we end this, I would like to know what your most terrifying day on the road was, if it wasn't in Finland.
Well, if you're talking about top 10, probably, you know, Finland is going to claim about 8 places in the top 10. I suppose there'd probably be an honorary mention for Russia, just because in Russia, you never quite knew what was coming around the next corner. Quite often coming around the next corner would be 3 lorries side by side.
I see.
Speeding towards you. So that was, and, then in Romania, when I got to Romania, it's still, even though it's part of the European Union, it still seems pretty, pretty desperate and poor and you know, rustic, I suppose. So there were lots of dogs just wandering around, and you know, obviously anyone who cycled through, you know, countryside areas on a bike will know that dogs can be an issue. And I really had some quite unforgettable moments. I think most dogs, they don't actually, I mean, only a couple of dogs actually bit me, but most dogs, they just want to accompany you at the very, very close quarters. But because you can't go very fast on a bike, there was sometimes it was like the kind of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Like, who are those guys? I could never shake them off. I'd be literally kind of, you know, pedaling at the top speed on this silly bike as fast as I could, and then after about, you know, a mile, I look around, the dog's still there. Finland, in terms of actually thinking I might not come home from this, probably Finland would have been the moments, because there were times when, you know, as I say, it was a very, very lonely place up there, sometimes 60 miles in between, you know, houses and nothing at all in between. So you know, and I didn't really know where I was going to stay, because I say I probably should have, if I'd been a bit more hardcore, I would have, you know, gone prepared to camp. But at my age, you know, I'm 52, for heaven's sakes. I want a reward at the end of a long day's cycle, and putting up a tent in a snowdrift is not a reward in my book. So anyway, and because I was dependent on other people to find me places and there were no other people, there were a few moments in Finland when I kind of, you know, all my batteries died. I had my little Garmin GPS, the batteries died on that. You know, my phone was going down. I didn't know where I was or what I was going to do. And there were at least a couple of moments. So I thought, like, well, there we are. This is how it ends. And I'm going to be, you know, discovered in some snowdrift when in spring when everything melts.
Well, the book is just delightful, and it's scary too. I mean, that's how it begins, is in Finland. So it's kind of like, okay, does this go downhill or uphill? Well, evidently it really does go downhill. But it was fun. I don't want to give anything else away. I'm going to ask you my usual weird questions, and we'll tell listeners how to get a copy of the book. So what's your favorite food now that you're home?
My favorite food is always curry. I just love curry. I mean, failing that, anything actually doused in Tabasco, which is, I think, it's because over the years, obviously doing these kind of bike rides, you end up having to, you know, you're permanently ravenous. You've got to eat a lot of food, and sometimes that food isn't very nice. So if you smother it all in chili sauce, it's fine. So, yeah.
From what I understand, chicken tikka masala is the, like, British dish right now?
Well, very well informed. It is apparently the most widely consumed dish in this country. So we've really kind of embraced curry and brought it to our hearts. But I've always loved it, and I now start. I make my own now on quite a regular basis, which is something I do enjoy. And
nice
curry that we eat in England is just apparently, because most of the Indian restaurants in this country are all staffed by people from a very particular part of Bangladesh. So it's the thing that we think of as curry is just representative of this tiny area in the Indian subcontinent and not actually the whole of India. But my favorite is, probably chicken jalfrezi, Rogan Josh. One of the sort of tomatoey, saucy ones with lots of nice bits. Smothered in lime pickle, which I can't get enough of.
What's your favorite music? What do you listen to?
Mainly 60s stuff. 60s kind of. I don't really like the Rolling Stones, but anyone else. I love the Beatles. Anything sort of slightly psychedelic, you know, Jimi Hendrix, all that kind of stuff. I keep waiting myself to move on. It's a bit depressing that I'm still. Well, I wasn't actually around then. I was born in 1964, so that can't really be the reason. But definitely the 60s.
You don't need to move on. I don't have a problem with any of that.
At this stage, I'm not going to move on. Obviously, you know, when you're 52, you're pretty much. I always kind of enjoy when people say, like, "Oh no," but they, you know, somebody, you know, so and so might change. I think, frankly, after the age of 18, nobody's going to change, really, are they? So,
do you have any pets?
I don't actually. I wish I did. I love cats, but my wife is allergic to them. So she nobly tolerated the cat she had when we got together. And then when it went to the big cattery in the sky, she said, "Actually, if it's all right, please, I'll deny you the privilege of more cats if it means that I'm able to breathe through my nose and not have water streaming out of my eyes." So, yeah, no pets for me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you can always go to the zoo, I guess, right? Or to the shelter, the animal shelter, and play with the animals. Are you there?
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
I'm just going to tell everybody how to get a copy of your book. And I know our Skype connection is not working too well right now. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I do love the book, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold. It's by Pegasus Books. We've been talking with Tim Moore. And if you can hear me, Tim, thank you very much. If not, I'll send you a message. How's that? And we'll talk again.
Thank you very much indeed.
All righty. Bye-bye. Tim Moore joined me from his home in London. And that was an interesting conversation. Unfortunately, we got a little discombobulated at the end of the interview. And I'm sorry for that. If you like cycling stories, this is a good one. The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold by Tim Moore. His other book, the one he referred to about riding the 1914 Giro on a wooden 1914 bike was called Geronimo. So if you have any interest in that book, that's available. Everything's available on Amazon and other book outlets. I'd also like to thank Damon Reinhard for being on the show with me this week. I hope that you enjoyed hearing the show. If you have a chance and it's nice where you are, go for a ride. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.